Let me first begin. I will introduce the panelists today all at once, and then we'll get into it. I'll have a brief introduction. This is our roadmap of our topic. And then we'll talk about each of the panelists will tell us the top three data security issues or trends of the next 18 months. And I have to say we've done a slightly different format than usually. I had each of them individually send in their top three items and their pragmatic data security advice. But none of the panelists know what another panelist has said. So as the saying is, you know, for David Letterman or Jimmy Kimmel or someone, we don't let people meet in the green room beforehand so that our show will be very exciting because it's all going to happen before you. So there was no green room. There was no pre-conference planning call. But all of their items have now been memorialized on this PowerPoint, and then they'll each get to go in turn. So first, the top three data security issues. We'll see if they agree or disagree with each other. Then we're going to have some pragmatic takeaways, data security advice for you, actionable items, and then we'll have time for questions and answers. So let me begin by introducing Travis LeBlanc, who is now making headlines, I think it's fair to say, as chief of the Bureau of Enforcement at the FCC, in particular with enforcement actions and his attempt to breathe life into the CPNI provisions in the Communications Act. Prior to joining the FCC, Travis served as a special assistant attorney general of California and a senior advisor to Attorney General Kamala D. Harris. And I guess 2 years ago you were the keynote here.
Yes.
So it's wonderful to have you back. And then next to you, we have Randy Sabat, who counsels clients at Cooley on a wide range of cutting-edge cybersecurity, privacy, IT licensing, and IP issues. And one of the things that I love, Randy, about your CV is it tells us that you served for several years of engineering experience in the information security marketplace, and you served with the NSA as a crypto engineer. So then, and then next to you is Michelle Weiser, who's at Ropes and Gray, one of our sponsors today. And Michelle focuses her practice on complex business litigation matters. She has extensive experience assisting companies in responding to a variety of legal issues. And when I went down the list of matters that you've worked on the company's website, it really got my attention that you've worked on such high-profile matters, including Target, including Heartland Payment Systems, including TJX. So all really front page of the newspaper matters. Then next to you is Kurt Wimmer, who's U.S. Chair of Covington's Privacy and Data Security Practice and a partner concentrating in privacy and technology law. He's also chair of the Privacy and Information Security Committee of the ABA's Antitrust Section. From 2000 to 2003, Kurt focused on EU data protection law in Covington's London office, where he was managing partner. And last night, Kurt and I were discussing how the weather is much better here in Silicon Valley than in London. And then
exactly.
Next to you is Ruby Zeffo from Intel Corporation, who leads the group at Intel that provides the company with global legal counseling relating to privacy, data security, and cybersecurity. She also manages the teams responsible for the global legal support of the company's IT department, as well as Intel's trademark and brand groups. Before joining Intel, Ruby spent 7 years at Sun Microsystems. Okay, so that's our wonderful panel today. And so I'm going to provide now a very brief introduction to this topic of data security, and then we will reveal the answers to the top three data security issues. So first, this is hopefully what we're not going to prove is true. Julie Angwin, in her wonderful book, Dragnet Nation, states, "The problem with computer security is that most of the advice we are given is absurd." So we'll see if our advice today is also absurd. Next, and to set the frame a little bit, exactly, I guess, a month ago, the president was here and had a cyber summit in Palo Alto. And so just wanted to talk a little bit about that. So Edit, he said that being president has given him this new appreciation of the issue of the government role in cyber attacks. The president also noted that connectivity brings benefits but also significant risks. Finally, one of the things that the president raised is the issue of information sharing between the private sector and the government. And he noted, the private sector has been largely reluctant to share information about threats with the government, arguing that it would create onerous regulations and potentially compromise proprietary and customer data. Okay, so someone else spoke at the event as well, a number of people, and I just want to pick out one of the speakers. So Tim Cook from Apple talked about how, and I think speaking indirectly to this issue in cybersecurity of private sector sharing of information with the government, that the companies are entrusted with the information by people, and that the company's interest vis-a-vis their customers may make them reluctant, reading between the lines of Tim Cook's speech, to turn over all the information that the government wants whenever the government wants it. So that's one big issue, this tension around information sharing obligations being placed on the private sector. Okay, now what I'd like to do is just drill down and give us a little bit of an overview of some trends in data security based on some empirical reports that we have. So first of all, Verizon Data Breach Report 2014, which is extremely helpful. The only thing that's not a little helpful about the Verizon data breaches over time is they've sometimes changed their methodology in various ways so that when you go through them year by year, it's a little confusing, but they're doing that to improve the methodology. So first thing that you can see is external threats, as Verizon looks at this, are a huge issue. And so that's the cyber attack issue. But if you look down at the lines for internal and partner threats, these continue to be quite significant. They're not going away. And in particular, and all the lawyers in the room know this, the liability issues are quite complex when you get to internal threats and partner threats. The standards are different. The obligations on companies are different. So even though that line for internal and partner threats is lower than the external threats, that doesn't mean that there's less liability potentially for customers. Okay, so now what I'd like to do is let me tell you about New York and California AG reports. These are extremely useful. The New York Attorney General and the California Attorney General get lots of information due to data breach notification reporting requirements pursuant to state law. So New York Attorney Generals. So first of all, I guess the good news here is if you're in this area of law, you're not going to want for work. So the number of reported data breaches, according to New York, tripled between 2006 and 2013. And then the other news here, it seems to me, is that the increase in size per data breach gets larger and larger. So there are more hacks, there are more cyber attacks, and they're getting bigger. Okay, what does California tell us? Well, really kind of the same thing here, namely the hacks are getting bigger. And if you look at this, it says 600% increase from 2012. But it also notes that in 2013, there were very large incidents that skewed the data. So it's still increasing at a great rate, 35% over 2012, if you take out the two largest breaches. So now we can think about for a second, why is this? Why are the breaches getting bigger and bigger? And it's, I think, largely because organizations are consolidating their data centers, their IT operations, which makes sense and makes things more efficient, but it also means that when there are hacks, the information that can be stolen and hacked is more consolidated than it was in the past. Okay, a couple more points, and then we'll be done with the overview. So first of all, we've been talking about Target. So the Target, it was a $191 million data breach And so note as well here that there's this $46 million insurance offset. And one thing that the panels will be talking a lot about is cyber insurance do's and don'ts. And so this has become a huge area which is extremely important. Note as well from this that we get this information from Target's filing with the SEC. So this is an area of law that has really spilled out beyond privacy and data security. It's about securities regulations. It's about shareholder lawsuits, possibly, if you haven't shared the right kind of information at the right time. Okay, so almost done here. So now let's talk about Sony, another big issue, and the interview. So the good news here is that Mike Myers reprised his Dr. Evil role on Saturday Night Live in response to the Sony hack. Because he kind of felt, I guess you could almost say, miffed by the Korean involvement in this, because he wanted to be the most evil person around. And so he responded to the situation. So that was the good news. The bad news is that here's something from CNN Money. 1 month after the hack, Sony was still crippled. They didn't have a functioning IT system in their company. So and note as well, the cost of this hack, clearly above $100 million, and even leaving aside the fact that there was an $80 million piece of intellectual property, the movie, on which they're going to lose a lot of money. So clearly over $100 million, just even leaving apart the $80 million movie, what this demonstrates is the enormous amount of operational risk tied to the whole data security issue. So this is really not just a matter of privacy and security. This is an existential question now for companies, as I think Target and Sony demonstrate. So that's our review. That's our little overview. And so let's look into the future of data security and turn to the panelists. So, we're going to do this like a David Letterman list, right? And as I told you, no one's met in the green room beforehand. So we're going to start, the last shall be first, alphabetically, and we're going to go to Ruby. How do you like that, Ruby? Z before anything. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to read off your items, and after each one, you can thank the Academy and also tell us why this is your third item. So we're going to go 3, 2, 1. Here we go. I've got them. And then the other thing I wanted to say is we have some celebrity people who will be doing the introductions, and they're actually holding up fingers to count down. So the countdown for item number 3, here we go, Jay-Z. Three. And thank you, Jay, for being here. And our item from Ruby, the top 3 data security trends, big data and cloud security. Yeah. Tell us about it, Ruby.
Well, I think big data has kind of got a pejorative taint to it now, which it doesn't deserve, because it's just data. It's not inherently good or evil. And the way it was collected may have been completely appropriate. So the name itself is not alarming to me. And you have to dig further below that to see whether or not it's something useful. So the CDC, for example, just won an award for eradicating polio, and they did that by using big data. There are a lot of other instances. People think of healthcare, but it could be traffic management, it could be anti-fraud, even business intelligence and making your products better so that people want them and they work better. And, of course, anti-terrorism, which is often what's given as an excuse for increased security measures. So I always ask people to take a step back before they make presumptions or conclusions about it, because it's a complicated issue. And then when you get to the security side of things, it's getting more complicated. So first we have these data localization issues that are cropping up, you know, Russia being the most recent one. But before that, Brazil had tried it and had deleted it, but it's probably going to bubble up again. And then the question becomes, is it about security or is it about data access? Is that why they want it stored locally? We're not going to know the answer to that. So so what should be done is difficult, and I don't think that often people realize how complicated the issues are before they start jumping on one bandwagon or the other. So it's here to stay. The cloud is wonderful. You know, our standpoint is it's not where it's made, it's how it's made. And just because a cloud provider is in your backyard doesn't make it more secure. Cloud providers have to have all kinds of security measures so that they provide a good and secure service, and that doesn't matter where it is. That's the point of the cloud. It's how it is.
Excellent. Okay, so trend number two, the countdown continues. And
still
to
me?
Introduce...
Pardon? I said, still me?
Yeah. Okay. Oh, yeah, you get three. Trend
right.
number two. And holding up two fingers, John Lennon.
All right.
Data breach preparedness and management.
Yeah.
Standards and enforcement against unreasonable security measures. NIST, FTC, class actions.
Well, first of all, I'm going to take issue with something that you just presented, which is how much these things are costing. I just read a week ago a report that put it in context of what the global revenues of the companies with the largest breaches are, and it's very low in the percentile. So I have to question whether the C-suite is still caring or not. And then there's the argument that if they manage it well, that it can be a brand enhancer, especially if it's something that seems like it wasn't their fault, you know, if it's a nation-state attack or something like that, and they manage it well and they're careful with the employees and the partners' data that was breached, then I think that can sometimes enhance a company's value. So, again, I think that's a little bit more complicated. It seems big on the numbers, especially if you're a small company, but if you're a large company, it's a little more complicated. But for the practical tip, it's not enough to have your written document. We do drills and testing all the time. And it really uncovers a lot of gaps. When everybody's in their role, you have a scenario, and you literally walk through how you're going to manage it, you end up with little corners that are important that you may have forgotten. And so my advice to people is to actually have those kind of drills and test their process. And on the enforcement side, you'll probably hear from the FTC later. Maybe the Wyndham case will be brought up. But personally, even if somehow the Third Circuit decided they can't use the unfairness prong to enforce these things, we'll have a big problem on our hands with respect to international commerce if we don't come up with some enforcement mechanism on what security means in this country. So from a global company's perspective, we want something in place, or we will get even more hammering from places like the European Union that we're not doing enough.
Excellent. Okay, and now your number one data security trend from Ruby.
Dun, dun, dun.
Here we go, and introducing it, Angela Merkel, which is very appropriate because of her phone being hacked by the NSA.
Yeah.
So she would probably have much to say about government access to data. So Internet of Things ecosystem, not just
favorite.
Consumer devices.
Yeah, this is my favorite because I see a lot of people focusing on the endpoint device and the security of the device. And I always use this picture of my 13-pound cat, and she's got my iPhone, and she's like, it's like the picture's really blurry because she's protecting it. And I said, this is, first of all, with security bolted on after the design, so it's not very elegant. And she's 13 pounds. It's not very portable. And it doesn't secure the entire ecosystem. All it secures is people away from my phone. But it's a good example of, I think, where the focus is. Is the endpoint device secure? Well, maybe it is, but okay. What about the app? Who's the app developer? Because almost all wearables, for example, and often other Internet of Things devices, are connected with an app. Who's the app developer? What are they doing with the data? How's the data getting from the device to the app? Often it's Bluetooth, which has been lately, you know, sort of given the jaundiced eye with regard to the security of its technology. And then it goes off to some data analytics provider because you want the data back from whatever that thing is connected. So who are they and what are they doing? Are they selling your data? What are they doing with it? And then it's got to come back to you. So that's out in the cloud somewhere. And maybe they're pushing it to you through your, you know, Google Mail account or something like that. So there's a whole bunch of people involved on the back end that you don't know typically as the end user device owner what's happening. And often you can't tell from the face of the device, assuming it has a user interface, even the things we're most fond of, like, you know, wearable watches and things like that. Those things are collecting a lot more data than is evident on the face. I have a basis band. It's collecting my heart rate, my temperature. I've shown my charts before because that really gives people religion on the types of data it's collecting that you cannot tell at all from the device itself. So I think we need to shift our focus into accountability for the whole ecosystem and who's going to be responsible for that, because most of those people don't have the end-user relationship. So if it's not the device person who's selling you the device and has a relationship with you, who is it?
Excellent. Okay, so now before we go on to Travis, who's next, I'd like to make a short disclaimer. which is the photographs of celebrities are being used solely for educational purposes. So I'm not implying any endorsement of celebrities. And since we are in California, I'd like to know that the right of publicity, fair use, has been safeguarded by the California Supreme Court in these following cases. So now let's go on to Travis. And Travis, item number three, trend number three, introduced by three members of the Bush family and the former president holding up three fingers. That was hard to arrange, but we were able to do it. Calls for increased security for connected devices. Travis.
Well, you know, I don't know that there's too much more that I can say than what just Ruby said, because I think it's fundamentally the same point about her number one, which is that with the increasing popularity of the Internet of Things and the massive amounts of information that's being collected by a lot of these devices, we have real concerns, I think, that we have to begin to address about the security of that information and how secure those devices are. So I think Ruby pretty much, you know, said everything that I would say about this, and I'm glad we agree on one point.
Trying to keep you happy. We're in California.
Okay, on to trend two. Trend two, introduced by Winston Churchill. And more sharing of information as regards data security threats, which was the issue at the Cyber Summit and the kind of little tension between Tim Cook and President Obama.
Right, but notice what I said at the end, which is whether with the government or between companies. And I think that's the real key thing. What we're seeing with a lot of nation-state threats in particular is that they are sometimes attacking industries. There have been times when, you know, multiple banks have been attacked all at the same time. And what we need to do is find a way so that when one company is victimized, they are sharing it with someone. Now, it doesn't necessarily, you know, there's a push to ensure that it's shared with the government, but there's also lots of initiatives to allow companies to share information with themselves so that others aren't victimized. And that's very important. You know, to me, it's no different than when you have a serial criminal out there, a serial murderer, for example, who is out, you know, terrorizing a particular neighborhood. You want to alert your other neighbors to what's ongoing out there. And, you know, the current model we have is you alert the government, and the government then alerts them. But I think there has to be some consideration if companies are not comfortable with sharing information with the government, at least finding a way to share it among themselves so that they can ensure that they're all, you know, on alert as to what's ongoing. So I actually think that the companies, for a lot of the reasons that Paul talked about, as to the recognizing the amount of risk that they have as a company, right? When you have an $80 million film, you know, that is potentially at risk, you're going to realize how important it is to ensure that they have as much real-time threat information as possible. And, you know, one way or the other, whether it's a government solution that's found or a market solution, I think inevitably we're moving towards that trend.
Okay. And trend number one is going to be, we've got the Dalai Lama introducing it, holding up one finger, more nation-state attacks on U.S. businesses.
You know, I did not look at the underlying data on the Verizon report that you presented, Paul, but I suspect that a lot of the massive breaches that we're seeing these days are emanating from abroad. And I don't think that's going to end. Some of you may have seen there was a call for a cyber war cabinet this week for the president. You know, I think there's a real concern that we're seeing a rise in the number of nation-state attacks, and that's not going to stop. And, you know, the big thing about it is they're not, you know, some of those nation-state attacks are not just to obtain access to personal data. You know, sometimes they're actually to, you know, to totally bring down a company's IT infrastructure. They just don't want you to operate. Other times it's in retaliation because, you know, I think the New York Times had this maybe 2 years ago where it was out there that China may have attacked the New York Times because of certain articles that were being published in China. And so they wanted to get access and intrude into their network. I think there's a real concern that that nation states are starting to attack us more and more, and the breaches that are occurring as a result of those attacks are much larger than, you know, a laptop being lost. And so I think we really have to begin to think as a country, and frankly also companies have to begin to think not just about data breaches but data preparedness, because when you have a nation state attacking you, you know, they're likely to invest a lot of money in trying to successfully intrude into the network or access the data. And I don't see an end to that coming, and in fact every year it seems to be going up more and more, and the breaches are getting bigger and bigger.
Thank you very much. So we're going to now turn to Randy. And Randy, trend number three, introduced by Mr. Bruce Lee, and Enter the Dragon. Increased adoption of the NIST framework.
So with the companies that I deal with and the clients that I deal with, when the NIST framework came out, there was a lot of excitement. Because people at least thought we finally have something that people can use to compare things on a, you know, apples to apples basis. Ruby touched on this in her list as one of the ways of kind of assessing good security. But I think that the confusion comes from how it's to be used. I mean, one of the things I've been, as Paul said in the introduction, I've been in the InfoSec business for many, many years. Somebody actually during one of the conversations beforehand asked, you know, when was I at NSA? And I said, I'd rather not say, because a while ago. But I was on the defensive side. I wasn't listening in on everybody else's stuff. But over the years, what we've seen is a number of different standards develop, but in a whole bunch of different areas. And when you get companies that aren't necessarily in the same space try to talk to each other, they're oftentimes doing this. We're going through a diligence right now, and there's a very data-intensive company involved in a set of documents that we're looking at, and it just amazes me that there's absolutely no mention of privacy or data security in a lot of their contracts. Fast forward a few years, and now we're talking about a way that we can compare companies, but it's not a standard. It's not something you can measure. It's not something you can audit. I think that's what a lot of people don't get. But here's, I think, the main thing that it does that is critically important, and this goes back to General Alexander, the former director of NSA, who he's actually misquoted as saying, this is the greatest transfer of wealth in history. Folks have seen that quote? Yes? Maybe? A few? Okay. That was actually Senator Whitehouse that said it a little bit earlier. But the idea is, all this attention on PII, you know, Ruby mentioned the numbers, it's shock value, $191 million. Yeah, that's, relatively speaking, a lot of money. In the broad sense, but relative to the company, it's not as big of a deal in many cases. The bigger issue is the IP that we're losing as a country, and there's really nothing to assess it, nothing to compare, nothing to say to companies, here's what you have to do. And I think the NIST framework is going to be something that, even though it was originally directed at critical infrastructure, is being talked about in a whole bunch of different areas. And I think it's going to give companies a chance to really be able to talk about this issue more clearly up front.
Thank you. So trend two, introduced by Robert Downey Jr. And it's the big data issue that we've already heard about, the sensorization of humanity.
Yeah, not a whole lot more to say on this one. Both Ruby and Travis talked about it. It really comes down to, I think, you know, striking the right balance. There's this significant uproar when people find out that their data was, you know, used in some particular way. You know, I question in how many of those cases, arguably, was there notice? It was probably buried. So I think we have to get better at, you know, providing notice. But I think in a lot of cases, people don't realize to get the convenience, to get the service, to get the whatever, that the value for that you're giving back is your data. So one solution is, don't provide your information for that, you know, free cat video if you don't want your information shared with somebody you don't know. But the sensorization aspect of it gets to the devices that some of us wear and the other things that are collecting information that we don't even know about. So I think we've got to strike a better balance.
Excellent. And so trend one, introduced by George Harrison, And no, actually, also by Paul McCartney, if you look at the picture. So it's actually Paul McCartney's thumb that's being held up. So great teamwork. And so the issue, turn number one, a more restrictive federal approach plus sector-based data security mandates. This is something we haven't heard much about yet, which is the balance between federal and state regulation.
Yeah, and I think this one, we've been talking for years and years and years, as everyone knows, about federal legislation in the space. And year after year after year, nothing comes out. And we all know the reasons why. I think the pressures and the dynamics are different. We're getting closer. I think we're doing a better job of crafting some of these bills. There's still obviously problems. I personally think, you know, the data sharing issue, legislation might be helpful. I was on the commission that delivered the report to the administration in 2008, and back then, you know, data sharing was a huge issue, and we thought it was really going to do a lot. And here we are, you know, 7 years later, and we're still not much further along. It's happening in some respects in the private sector. You've got the FSI SAC, you've got these trust relationships established among different organizations, but we're not seeing it at a national level. And I think what we're going to see is an approach from a federal perspective where we are seeing more restriction, and I think the FCC is a good example of that. But I think getting to a point where we have an across-the-board cybersecurity legislation is going to be difficult, if not impossible, except in maybe a few very narrow areas like a federal data breach law. That, I think, is one area where people can agree. But in other areas, it's going to be difficult. So,
okay. Excellent. And so, Travis, did you want to respond to the notion of the more restrictive federal approach? Or?
Sure. I'll respond to the sector-based approach because okay. I do think that I think the likelihood of legislation coming through this year, just as you know, you said, and for many years, it's not high. However, there are many sectors that have specific data security mandates as well as privacy rules that are in place, whether it's healthcare or financial information or communications information. And as many of you may know, yesterday the FCC released the open internet order around net neutrality. And there's a whole discussion in there about privacy. If you haven't had a chance to read it, I would encourage you to do so. It really isn't that many pages, although the entire document is 400 pages. The privacy part is you could sit down and read in a relatively short time. But what the commission makes clear is that Section 222 of the Communications Act include several privacy requirements that are going to apply to broadband internet service, whether it's, you know, mobile or landline. And, you know, right at the beginning of Section 222, it makes very clear that there is a duty on now a broadband internet service provider to protect the proprietary information of customers, namely social security numbers, what we all know of as commonly understood as PII. And I think that what we're going to see is suddenly we're now bringing a regime, the Communications Act, and particular provisions of it, some of which have been forbeared from in Title II, to apply to internet service providers. And I think that's going to be actually a big trend that you're just going to see from the federal side, is that there's a lot of attention right now that's being paid to internet service providers. Because if you think about how much information is going on their networks, and you begin to think about the trends that we're seeing with convergence, right? Just to the triple play, right? Think of your cable provider who is also your phone provider, who is also your internet service provider, and they're gaining all that information, they're collecting it all, and they're sharing it, you know, and you know, between them. And you know, you're beginning to see that your web search results are suddenly showing up with ads on television. We're only so far from that. It's not 5, 10, 15 years. We're actually much closer to the possibility that, you know, the phone calls that you're making are suddenly leading to ads on your computer when you're connected to your Wi-Fi and browsing. And all of these are connected. We have to begin to think about how how they're shared, the obligations that are on the Internet service providers, and the Communications Act, as well as the new Open Internet Order from the Commission, I think is beginning to say, is beginning to really make clear that there are going to be some sector-specific, you know, rules that are going to apply there. And I think it's not only important, I think it's a great evolution for all of us going forward. I certainly know from the enforcement standpoint at the FCC, it's something that we're really starting to think about as the new rules begin to go into effect.
Great. Okay, we'll now hear from Michelle. And so trend number three, introduced by executives from Google. And so namely Clapper and its impact on standing issues in civil litigation.
Sure. So, I mean, this is an issue, of course, that's very relevant to me as a litigator dealing with many of these data breach cases. And, you know, the real issue here is, although there's, you know, often big splashes in the news of these class actions following data breaches, the real question of do consumers even have standing to be suing when this happens, when this information is stolen, because really what's the likelihood that any harm is going to befall them? And there are a number of studies showing that, indeed, the likelihood of that harm is slight. And for a number of years, I mean, these cases have been going on for 10-plus years now, and there was a mix of opinion in terms of do they have this basic standing to be before the court. And almost exactly 2 years ago, today now, it was back in late February, the Supreme Court had the decision of Clapper, which many thought was going to be a real game changer in heightening that bar, clarifying how high it was, you might say, that injury really has to be certainly impending before consumers could sue. And at the time that decision came out, there was a lot of buzz in the data security litigation space in terms of, is this finally going to be that death knell to these consumer cases? And a lot of people predicted that it would be, but now it's been 2 years out, and while it has been the case that the majority of courts that have been faced with this have said, yes, that's accurate. Consumers, you know, who have their credit card information is stolen for a number of reasons, mainly being that, you know, it's the card brands that ultimately pay the price or the merchant, depending on how those contracts work out, the consumer themselves isn't harmed with Social Security numbers. The likelihood of actual harm happening is slim, and therefore there's no standing. Some courts have gone the other way. The Neiman case is currently... it has been before the Seventh Circuit, so we might get more clarity there. But in general, you know, over the next 18 months, the real question of will we get more clarity on whether this decision, and really some would say what the law always has been, means that this is not an area where consumers have a right. And again, this goes to a major concern for companies. Oftentimes in the way these cases work, they're either dismissed early or settle early. It's not the major cost component, but the reputational impact of these class actions can be huge. They're in the news much more so than your government investigations or card brand investigations. So it is a real concern for companies, you know, what's the future of consumer class actions? And, you know, as there's been no slowdown in large breaches, you know, likely we will have more decisions over the next couple years, and hopefully we'll get some clarity one way or the other.
Excellent. And so trend number two, introduced by executives from Apple, and they're looking at that device and thinking, one day we'll be able to sell this at Sotheby's at an auction. Just don't throw it out, Steve. Don't throw it out. Okay. Another Internet of Things trend, and as Randy said, the sensorization of humans. So, Michelle?
Right, and I think, you know, this is obviously a topic that a lot of us are thinking about here. It's shown up on a number of lists, and a lot's already been said. And the one thing that I'll just focus on, and this, I think, harkens back to the quote from Obama that we had at the beginning of this session, is, you know, there's that real tension between the benefits of this technology and the risks. And, you know, as many of you probably know, the FTC came out with its Internet of Things report earlier this year, and that was one of the issues that was discussed a lot in the workshops with a number of people, you know, making the strong point that these devices, and this goes to the points Ruby was making about big data as well, there can be huge benefits, and the points Randy was making about convenience for consumers. And it's, I think, very easy for people to say, yes, it should be secure. All the information about me should be secure. But if you, I think, would ask a lot of consumers, you know, do you want better technology? Do you want the ability to, you know, have these devices where you can manage your home security from your car, from your office, from anywhere? They'll say yes, certainly.
But will they pay for it? Will they pay for that security?
Exactly. So either one, will they pay for the security, or will they decide that as between that security and giving up the risk to my data, you know what, that's fine. Have my data. And especially, I think there's another concern, too, that, you know, will probably play itself out in the next couple of years, and this goes to my number 1.2, of the question of what data is really secure, or what data is really deserving of security. There's a number of types of data, from, you know, your traditional PII of financial data, social security numbers, driver's license numbers. We're seeing a trend now saying, okay, user credentials, that's on the list. With the Internet of Things, you know, the first FTC case has been the TrendNet case, where there was a complete unfairness prong, and there it was just being able to, you know, the cameras that let people view the insides of someone's home. You know, that's not personal data about you, but that's seeing you. So really, what's the line, and where are we going to draw that, and making sure that the security requirements are proportional? So, you know, in its report, the FTC has indicated its intention to continue to be active in its enforcement space. And, you know, hearkening to something we haven't mentioned much, but, you know, there's the issue generally of, you know, what is the FTC's authority under the unfairness prong in any event? You know, that's something that's being challenged in the courts right now. And where on this Internet of Things spectrum does that lie? So I think we're going to, you know, be seeing a lot more in the next 18 months, and it'll be interesting how that develops and what lines are drawn and what balances are made.
Excellent. That flows perfectly into your first trend, introduced by Neo from The Matrix, the one. So we'll really just this whole issue, what's sensitive information? So any further comments, Michelle?
Right. So I think, you know, I hit on that in the Internet of Things context. You know, one of the interesting things that's happened in the past couple of years, and I think might drive the either enforcement or class action activity we're seeing going forward, is new efforts to broaden the spectrum of what's sensitive. I'm thinking in particular of the California and Florida data breach notification laws that have been passed recently that have now added to the definition of standard PII user credentials. And, you know, what we've seen in the trend from enforcement activities and litigation in the past is that it was out of those initial breach notification laws listing what was PII that we started to see enforcement activity following, and regulators asserting that businesses had an obligation to protect this information. And this creates an interesting dynamic now, is because a lot of businesses, I think, you know, without saying one way or the other whether the government would have the right to be enforcing these laws under this theory, you know, have adjusted their practices based on that guidance. And so they've taken steps to further segregate, further protect what they consider to be those carved out categories. And now, to the extent that we see regulators or plaintiffs saying, okay, well, now user credentials are in this bucket, and now, you know, pick whatever else it might be, and continuing to try to broaden that puts companies at a real disadvantage that haven't historically been focusing on those types of information. So I think it's probably fair to say right now, if you went to many companies and said, what are you doing for credit card information? What are you doing for social security numbers? What are you doing for your driver's license numbers? They could tell you, oh, they're in this, you know, segmented network. We have XYZ protections around them. And then you say, you know, what are you doing with the user credentials you collect? And, oh, that wasn't something we were focusing on. But the government has signaled, I think, through these laws, this is something that we're now going to be looking into. And there have been cases, Zappos in particular, where a multi-state group of attorneys general entered a settlement that contained both a fine and, I think, some pretty onerous injunctive relief, and that was based on theft of information that didn't include any of the traditional PII categories. And so I think that's, you know, a real signal of what might come, again, with a whole overlay question of, is there authority for regulators? Is there a law that would allow consumers to actually bring actions based on those types of allegations?
You know, Paul, I have no idea who would have come up with that crazy California law that she's talking about. Joan, I don't know if you have ever had any thoughts about who, but I will defend a concept of looking at credentials, because I'm just guessing that what may have been behind that law was the idea that our data and is only secure as access to it. And the trend that we started to see is, so everybody knows that their password, you know, that you've got to have a pretty tough password. But what they don't know, you know, is, you know, one, you know, they often use the same password across multiple sites. And so if there's a breach of one, then suddenly you're exposed through every single site that you have. But the second issue that we also saw was that those passwords were only as secure as the underlying questions behind them. So if everyone, you know, if you've got this strong password in the, and you go and you click on something and it says, you know, I forgot my password, and the question it asks is, where did you go to high school? And that's information that anyone can Google or find out on Facebook or anywhere else, then your password is only as secure as the publicly available information that's out there. And so what we started to see and recognize was that it was very important to ensure that user credentials were also protected there. And I'm, you know, and that's a trend, you know, where we're seeing that once you get access to that, you've got what I like to say is, are the keys to the kingdom to just roam around the internet and to, you know, essentially steal someone's virtual identity everywhere on the internet. So it was a real concern, at least in the state of California, when I was in the state of California. And I just, you know, I think that it bears stating that I do agree with you that it'll be a trend. And I personally, speaking in my personal capacity, think it's not the worst thing.
Okay.
Right. I guess the one thing I would add to that is I think there's also, and I appreciate those thoughts, but a distinction, too, between a notice requirement, which might be justified to, you know, let people know that this information, you know, has been accessed so that they can take steps to protect themselves. I won't say one way or the other what my underlying views on the notice requirement are, but I think there's the separate step of, you know, if we go the next step forward and say, and there's also a legal obligation to protect this. And, you know, looking at, again, what law is out there, and I guess I'll focus on the Section 5 right now, on the unfairness prong, that this part of that that people often ignore, I think, is it's harm that consumers couldn't protect themselves against. And I mean, how many people have not heard the advice of don't use the same password on numerous sites, especially for your sensitive information? So I think, you know, as a general legal ground, there's a real question as to whether if someone was able to compromise a password, that's something that a consumer, if the risk was that it's used somewhere else, that consumers couldn't be protecting themselves against that, especially with their very sensitive information.
Randy? Yeah, I just want to add one more comment to keep in mind. So all this discussion right now, again, going back to what I said earlier, has been around PII. Mm-hmm. Recall that a lot of y'all's network is run by people who have different levels of privileges. And in a lot of these data breaches, what we find when we're working with the forensic investigators is the attackers use what's called lateral movement. So, you know, I agree with everything that was said about the public, you know, PII aspect, but as far as inside your network, if your credentials aren't protected, the attackers can get a hold of someone's, move over, because they've got access to certain areas of the network which have some of these credentials unprotected, and all of a sudden get the credential for perhaps the CISO, which is what just happened in one of our recent cases. So there's the PII side, but again, from a trade secret, from a sensitive information perspective, there's also the inside the network piece that you have to look at.
Excellent. Okay, we will now turn to Kurt. Kurt's trend number 3, introduced by Nelson Mandela, holding up three fingers. And Kurt's the first one to, I guess, so far to talk about the international issues.
Thanks, Paul. I was just going to say, I don't know if there are any issues left after this discussion, but it's nice to see one that we haven't talked about too much. So, you know, there is a movement in Europe to pass a new data protection regulation. Currently, it's set up as a directive, so the 1995 directive was implemented by every country. Every country has a little bit slightly different implementation and a different regulator. So Europe is moving toward a general data protection regulation, which would apply everywhere without being implemented. And part of it is data breach notification. And it was very interesting to see the learning curve for Europe. it's somewhat annoying to my European colleagues when I say, look, we are way ahead of you on this. And it's really true. I mean, we've had data breach notification for, you know, years and years. And, you know, they're just now starting to look at it in Europe. At the same time, it's important to recognize that a lot of countries haven't waited on the regulation to move ahead and have, you know, their own breach notification standards. So, you know, in Paul's favorite country, Germany, you know, there is a breach notification standard. And in many other, and, you know, Poland, Sweden, a couple others in Europe, a few of the Asian countries, Japan, Taiwan, Korea, and a couple of countries in Latin America. And, you know, it's interesting because they're different. They're usually notifications of the regulator. You'd have to call a regulator and tell the regulator that you've had a breach, and then they'll tell you what to do. And many other countries, the UK, for example, it's not a requirement, but your regulator sort of expects to hear from you if you had, you know, something that really significantly adversely affects consumers. So, you know, I do think it'll be interesting to see what happens with the regulation, which is, you know, heating up again, and, you know, there's talk now. I don't know if the one-year presidency of the EU makes it very hard to move anything through, and I think for a lot of people in this room that's probably a good thing because there are pieces of the regulation that are very restrictive, very anti-innovation. At the same time, I think if this moves through, it will absolutely have notification requirements.
Okay. And Kurt's next trend, introduced by the First Lady of the United States, Michelle Obama, is turned to legislation.
Yes. So we have been, as Randy pointed out, you know, every year the legislation is introduced. Every year it goes to hearing and people talk about it and it languishes and doesn't pass. I actually think back in the time frame you were talking about, Randy, 2008, 2009, it was much less partisan. And when the Republicans took the House in 2010, it became a partisan issue really for the first time. And that's when progress stopped. I do think there's a chance for some legislation to move through Congress this year. It was interesting that the president introduced the legislative package in the State of the Union address and really put the administration's weight behind it in front of a Republican Congress. And I'm not sure if that was meant to increase the chances of it passing or decrease the chances of it passing. There is a way that this becomes a campaign issue in 2016 by having it not pass, and maybe that had something to do with it. But there are several different components of that if you unpack what he proposed. One is a Consumer Privacy Bill of Rights, which has now been delivered and is probably dead on arrival. There is a cybersecurity legislation, which in this context really just means sharing data with the government when there is an incident. There's the data breach notification and general security legislation, which is, again, separate. And there have now been proposals introduced to change the Children's Online Privacy Protection Act, another area in which we're ahead of the Europeans. Thank you. So, you know, there are a lot of different things happening. And so I think the CISA, the cyberspace or the cybersecurity act is pretty likely to pass, actually. It got out of committee yesterday on a 14-1 vote. Only Senator Wyden voted against. The real holdup on that legislation for years has been the issue of privacy of user data. If you're going to share information with the government, if that information, you know, includes data about individuals, privacy advocates have rightly been concerned that the government might get access to that. And that's what Senator Wyden was talking about persuasively yesterday. That's been a holdup, but in a two-House Republican-controlled Congress, I think it'll be less of a holdup. And it's also got a national defense angle to it, especially after Sony. So I think that one's going to pass. I think the breach notification bill is going to be very dicey because of the preemption issue. I think the states are going to push back hard on that, and it'll be interesting to see if that happens. Frankly, I think it's a little bit late. I mean, if it were, you know, right after the first Sony data breach, the PlayStation breach, it would have been really helpful to have federal legislation. But we've kind of internalized this 47 states plus D.C. Patchwork quilt of different requirements, and it's not hugely onerous. The risk is, for industry, I think, is that all the different states just layer on different things, and then it's not just difficult logistically to figure out your obligations toward various different state state residents. It can really sort of feed back in and change the substance of what you're doing. And I think the Consumer Privacy Bill of Rights is not going anywhere. I think that the chance of the Republican Congress giving the FTC greater regulatory authority are about zero.
Okay, excellent. So Kurt's trend number three was international. Trend number two is legislation. Trend number one, we've got Paul McCartney back.
Yeah.
With the president of France. Insurance coverage for breach costs will become more contentious.
Yeah, so we've talked about insurance a fair bit today already, so I won't extend it too much. I do think it's an area that is going to be more litigious. Insurance companies are pushing back against having the general CGL policy cover data breach costs. There's a case recently in New York relating to the first Sony PlayStation network breach that goes the wrong way for policyholders, which is worrying. One reason that it's not just because they don't want to pay out money that they're pushing back, it's because, surprise, they have another product to sell you, which is cybersecurity insurance. So, there is that. I think since the Sony breach, more and more companies now are looking at their insurance portfolio, going over it with the people in Treasury, making sure that they've got coverage where they need coverage. You know, you can buy breach insurance now. It's, you know, you can't buy a ton of it. I mean, I think it's limited at maybe $500 million. But as Ruby pointed out, that covers a lot of the costs of most data breaches. So, you know, I think companies are going to look very closely at that. I think the policyholder versus insurance company dynamic is going to be even more difficult, especially for breaches that might have been covered by CGL policies.
Excellent. So we are now going to turn to pragmatic advice, although we certainly have already gotten much great advice. And I had to switch kind of the theme here a little bit because I was thinking who embodies wisdom and pragmatism. And so there you have it.
Nice. Do we have to speak backwards?
Yeah. So what I'm going to do now so that we can get through all of these wonderful suggestions is I'll read down 3, 2, 1, and then we'll turn to Ruby. So then I had to come up with somebody, and it was Elmo, because it's all about kind of being prepared, what Ruby's going to tell us, and I thought Fireman Elmo would be perfect. Also, because we've seen so many distinguished people, Nelson Mandela, First Lady of the United States, and so on, Beatles. You know, how do you top that? And I thought it could only be Elmo. So number three was it's not enough to have an undocumented, untested data breach preparedness plan. And then number two and one, document your reasonable security measures. And then finally, the need for clear communication from the top down regarding security. Ruby?
Well, Elmo says that. Sorry, you asked for it.
And all of this was unscripted.
I already talked about the other one, so I'm only going to talk about number one. And that one is really hard. It sounds like it's easy. And I think it's hard even for a small company, but for a large company, I think it's doubly hard. So, take IT, for example. If I go to IT and we talk about a security tool and what it's going to do to monitor employees, I will get arguments over what the right thing to do is because no one's basically in agreement. Once you bring it personal to the person you're talking about, whether it's the board, the C-suite, or somebody else, then all of a sudden they care, and they have their own very personal opinion about it, and an argument ensues, which I love because it gets the conversation going. But if you multiply that, now that's even in a single corporate culture. We have a very unusual corporate culture. You multiply that by other corporate cultures in your state or country, and then you multiply that by the world and their cultures, and then you add the other dimension of the law in there, which is in a giant state of flux, as we know. And then there's another dimension of ethics and what the right thing to do is. You end up with a very difficult situation of what you should stand for. And I always bring up Tim Cook because I was lucky to be in the audience that day, and I found his little 10-minute talk extremely engaging because there was no waffling. I hear a lot of waffling from other companies. He did not vary from his message that they care, true or false, they care about your privacy. Here's what we're going to do about it. And he was extremely clear on that point. I think an excellent person to demonstrate what I'm talking about. But, you know, you've got profit and loss piled in there. So some guy wants to sell the data that he's gathering off of something, and then another guy doesn't. So so it's a difficult situation. And I think it all then boils down to the laws. To me, that's the low bar. You have to be, I mean, if you're a reputable company, you have to obey the law, whatever it is, and we'll give you our best guess. After that, you have to have the conversation, which is, what should we do? Not what can we do, but what should we do? Because what will bite you in the ass is if you've got a policy from one group that says this is what you're going to do, and then the other group violates it. Now you're back in legal territory. Because as we know from early cases, enforcement cases, even just violating your own policy can bring a legal action down on you, even if what you otherwise would have done is legal, because you said you weren't gonna. So I find that a very difficult thing, and our CEO just came out with a little statement I posted, if you want to look at it, it's called the Privacy Philosophy, and it has a couple little points he wanted to make about it, and I'm glad that we're getting that direction, but it's very difficult to do that in a very consistent way across the company.
Okay, excellent. Now we're going to turn to Randy, and what Randy says is, number three, form a tiger team. Talk to them. And then wash, rinse, and repeat. And so from the notion of the tiger team, well, I came up with Tony the Tiger. Also, by the way, a source of possible sponsorship for next year's event. I'll have to see if Jim wants to follow up. Okay, pragmatic advice. This is great, right? So the Fram ad campaign, pay me now or pay me later, and so investing in data security can actually save millions later on. And then number one piece of advice, we've been hearing about cyber insurance, but read the details. Randy?
Sure. So it was interesting listening to Ruby's because there's a lot of overlap here, which is good to hear. On the, you know, the tiger team notion comes from what I used to do, some of the things I used to do at NSA. Whenever there was a particular problem, they'd pull in different people, multidisciplinary people from all different parts of the agency, and sort of figuratively lock us in a room, you know, throw us food every now and then, and we'd come out and we'd have an answer or we'd have a solution or whatever. The idea here, and I work with my clients on doing this, is get together the right people. Make sure you have the people at the top. You know, I call it tone from the top. If the folks at the top of the chain aren't supporting your security and your privacy efforts, then it's going to be really difficult to roll things out that are actually, you know, latched onto by the organization. So that's the tiger team notion. The Fram oil filters, I bring this up frequently with folks talking about, for those of you who remember the campaign, you had the guy kind of polishing some sort of wrench. And he's saying, you know, spend a few more dollars on buying our better oil filter now up front, or, and then he points over here, and there's some guy with, you know, covered in grease pounding on this engine, you know, pay me later. And the idea here is pay up front, or you could pay a lot more later on. Now, that's not necessarily an absolute rule. I think, as Ruby pointed out, there are companies out there who view this essentially as a cost of doing business. Why would I want to spend $100,000 today when I might not get hit? We've got decent security. I want to put that $100,000 toward a better set of servers or, you know, some new people or whatever the expenditure is going to be. So it's not necessarily a hard and fast rule, but I think we've seen too many companies that go that way without thinking about the consequences. And then that kind of leads into the number one issue, the cyber insurance, which we have talked a lot about. I think the pragmatic stuff here, I have just in not even the past year, probably about the past 8 months, have been through with two different companies serious situations where there's arguments over whether or not it's not a CGL policy, it's an actual cyber insurance policy, and the insurance company is coming back and saying, nope, you're not covered. And, you know, the company's sitting there saying, I bought this policy. I listened to my agent. Don't always listen to your agent is the one takeaway. We had one client who, they don't have any first-party PII. They don't collect information from consumers. They're a B2B play. They have information that they store on behalf of other companies. Their policy only had first-party coverage. It didn't have the third-party coverage. So we had to go through this huge argument, and there was other language in there that, you know, we were able to work with and at least get something compensated. But there's a lot of talk about insurance right now. The takeaway is don't just go out and buy a policy. Vet your agent, and there are some really good ones out there. I won't mention names, but if you want to talk to me afterwards, I can put you in touch with folks. And make sure you read, work with your legal team and your also your technical team to make sure that that they read that policy closely.
Excellent. Thank you. And so now we'll go to Kurt. And so Kurt is talking about the need for an incident response plan. So there we have Daffy Duck. And the notion is be prepared before the accident, have the lines of authority in place, and negotiate the master services agreement. And then, like Randy, the next issue is about the need to review the insurance policy and look at the details. And then finally, number one piece of pragmatic advice is about securing human resources and training. Kurt?
Yeah, so this I think, follows on Randy's theme of being prepared. The wonderful thing about the Sony breach was two things. First, it got a lot of companies who weren't thinking about security to think about security. And it wasn't because of the cost. It was because of the way that the Sony breach happened, the way that the highly embarrassing and damaging information was leaked out, the way it was sort of doled out in a very PR-savvy way to damage the company as much as possible, and that got everyone's attention. It wasn't really the costs. It was more the risk to the company, the reputational risk. And the good thing about that is it's getting people to prepare, and it's freeing up some budget for privacy professionals that otherwise had a hard time, being able to do a lot of this. I mean, it's not cost-free to do a tabletop exercise or a breach simulation, but it's certainly a good thing to do. And it's also put a light on the fact that a lot of breaches aren't really, brute force attacks or something that is that the government of China is behind. A lot of breaches happen from human error, and we're starting to see a lot more companies focus on training people and a lot more privacy professionals, like the people in this room, getting more leeway to go ahead and start training programs to try to, bring up the sophistication level of the general user population in a company so that, maybe the phishing attempts don't succeed.
Excellent. So we'll hear from Michelle now. And it's really fascinating to me the way the pragmatic advice is lining up to talk about things like just basic preparation. So this is the incident response plan. And also, as Michelle and I discussed, knowing what happened before you talk about it. Here's the illustration. I thought for a while about this. But it really, the point is that the PII is really the gold of the organization. So then I immediately thought about poor Uncle Scrooge and his constant battle against the Beagle Boys to protect all his gold. And so that seems to be the situation we have now, with the gold being the PII and the need of the organization to protect it. So what else do we expect? Well, I guess that's the information vault now. That's, of course, Uncle Scrooge's gold vault. And here's Uncle Scrooge diving into his gold, and I guess now it's the organization trying to control its PII to extract value from it. Michelle goes on to say, number two, need to do risk assessments on a regular basis. And then finally, knowing where the information is. Michelle.
So I guess I'll focus briefly on number three. This is the area that so many of us have mentioned that. It's just be prepared, be prepared, be prepared. And the key issue there that I want to just briefly highlight is, doing it with an eye towards litigation. I think this was on Kurt's slide as well of, a response to a data breach, it's almost guaranteed if it's a large breach that hits the news, there's going to be either a class action lawsuit or a governmental inquiry or likely both. And so in general, you should be looking, and separately, you have breach notification obligations, which are a legal issue. So it makes perfect sense to have the lawyers involved from the get-go, managing the process and preserving privilege. And testing the plan is important. I mean, one of the key things there, just pragmatic advice of, if you have your IS team that is regularly managing incidents that fall just below that line of being critical, and they never interact with the lawyers, they've never met the outside counsel that's going to be brought in to oversee this breach investigation, that communication or lack thereof is going to be very problematic when the incident happens, and these are people that are used to running the show. So beforehand, do the tabletop, have interaction, regularly go to legal with less than severe events so that people can get used to the process so that you don't have a situation where a breach happens, you have communications running off and issuing press releases that the litigators haven't reviewed, that you have, you know, emails being circulated widely within the company speculating as to what might happen. So just having that general, this is the plan, this is a legal issue in place, is very key. I'll touch briefly on risk assessments. I think that folds into it again as well. And, you know, to Ruby's point on the issue of what's reasonable security, there's a lot of components in that. And one of it really is, for better or worse, that's the legal framework. So lawyers do have a proper role and a key role in terms of evaluating the company's security and, you know, looking at what we have that's maybe just tea leaves right now, but it's helpful for a company to understand how might plaintiffs assert you're not being reasonable, how might regulators assert you're not being reasonable, and having that part of the general process of evaluating where you should make changes. And, you know, one of the key things that we've seen from the guidance is you need to do risk assessments. The threats change constantly. The protections that you can have in place are constantly improving. So regular security 2 years ago very well might not be regular security today, and having the proper people involved. And then, as well to Ruby's point of, there's going to be a lot of disagreement in terms of what steps should we take, what's reasonable. And doing that within the environment where, you know, lawyers are participating, you can have a privileged discussion and frankly discuss these things without creating a lot of documents with 47 recommendations that you're not going to do. And you're reasonably not doing them. But it's a real problem when these are not privileged documents. After the fact, people are looking at them and accusing you in each case that you are unreasonable for not taking these steps. With hindsight, it's very easy to make those accusations, even if things were reasonable at the time. So a good way to protect that is to do that within the bounds of the proper privileged relationship, because this really is a legal issue.
Thank you so much. And now we're going to hear from Travis, and the person from the federal government gets the last word. How appropriate. And so let me go, and we're going to get our last number one piece of pragmatic advice. I'm very excited to find out what it will be. So I'll count down three. Data security standards for any contractor or agent. So pushing the obligation down the chain of the information. Two, outside counsel, review your firm's data security practices. So lawyers, yes, you need data security as well. And so lawyers represented by one of the greatest lawyers of all time, Snoopy, at least in his own mind. And then finally, number one item represented by my wife and daughter's favorite Beatle, Ringo Starr. So, number one, here we go. Develop a breach response plan now. Travis.
I'll keep this very quick because you've heard a lot about breach preparedness this morning, but that's clearly what mine focus on. I will highlight the one issue that Paul raised just a second ago about my, I think it was my second piece of pragmatic advice, which was law firms. You know, I can't tell you the number of investigations and cases that I've worked on where involving data breaches, where a company comes in and it says, look, we know we had a breach, but it was due to a third-party contractor or partner. It was due to an inadvertent, you know, technical glitch. It was due to an errant employee. But that inadvertent, that the third-party contractor partner actually comes up quite often. And law firms get a lot of sensitive information. You know, and I think for law firms, the challenge is a lot of the companies are starting to get wind of this and want to place various requirements, data security practices on the data that they're sharing with you. And I think as a law firm, you have to learn, how are we going to meet all these various clients who are coming to us and saying, well, we want you to treat our data this way, and we want you to secure our data this way, and just making sure that the law firm can operate within that environment. So I would encourage everyone to start thinking about it. And then the other thing I'd say is, you know, from the preparedness standpoint, is just thinking about how to ensure that the data preparedness and the value of that is built in and baked in from the top down, not just the bottom up. So often we talk about privacy by design, which is kind of baking something in at the bottom layer, but we also need to think about it top down, which means making sure that at the C-suite level, you don't just have someone that is going to take ownership of privacy and data security issues, but they actually know something about privacy and data security. And that's something I'm thinking about as we begin to, you know, seek in injunctive terms or in our agreements, where we're sort of starting to think about, you know, is this person knowledgeable about how to actually protect data and to prevent a data breach in the future? And then also thinking about it at the board level, right, is I think another thing that we have to think about, at the governance structure for the organization, are they too, do they have people on the board that are aware of these kinds of issues and able to advise on them?
Thank you so much. So this is great. We have time for at least one question. So let's hear from you. And I've got my little slide, questions and answers, represented by, we went back to Uncle Scrooge. So any questions from the audience? I'd like to hear from someone. Yes.
There's an article, I think, that Stuart Baker made comments about the overall price tag of these breach incidents being paltry compared to the net values of the companies involved, and therefore that the need for insurance or preventive measures were being unduly exaggerated. I wondered what the panelists would like to say in response to Stuart Baker.
Okay, so the question was, how necessary is really cyber insurance if you think about how much big tech companies make? Would anyone like to address that?
It's a fair point. I had a CEO of a company tell me a couple of weeks ago, you know, it's great that we've got this insurance. We figured out that we can, you know, we've gotten the right policies, and that'll be helpful if we have a breach. But, you know, at my last company, we had a breach, and it was covered by insurance. But the biggest problem was the hit to our reputation and the fact that everybody had to reset passwords and we lost X amount of business, and it was really devastating. So I do think it's possible to overstate the value of insurance. It's just one of those things that you want to make sure that you've got. I mean, it goes in the nature of an incident response plan, you know, being able to do a tabletop exercise, figure out how to preserve privilege and make sure that you've got the basics covered, but it's certainly not a panacea.
And Michelle, did you want to say anything about that? Because I know this is in your wheelhouse.
Sure. I mean, I think it's, in terms of just the dollar value, too, I mean, my general reaction to that is that may be true for some companies, but it's important to also put that in perspective of, you know, with some of the cases that we've worked on, depending on how things would have gone, it could have actually been disastrous. You know, there have been companies that have been very concerned about the risk of bankruptcy from these types of events. So, you know, for the very, very large players, you know, just given the level of damages that could result from this type of matter, that might be true. But I think there's a lot of, you know, more mid-market players where having that insurance can be the difference between a really disastrous situation for the company and something that they can, dealing with the reputational issues, still get through.
I think that's really true.
Okay, we have time for one more question.
I was a general counsel and a chief privacy officer, and I had a personal experience that was very negative, which we had a great company, great technology, never had a problem with an AG or with the FTC, and yet in an M&A situation, Microsoft still walked away because of the potential reputational issues. Do any of you have horror stories that you can share to help motivate the business people? Because I think it's impossible to get them to focus on extra cost items. They just don't even want to hear about that, investing in IT, investing in insurance. But it would be helpful, I think, to the group if this panel could share some of the best horror stories outside of that limited rubric of why the CEO should care.
That's a great point about the M&A issue. And does anyone want to speak to that? That the company looking down the road have to realize this is going to be an issue if they want to be acquired.
So I mentioned earlier, maybe it was an aside conversation, I've got three different deals I'm working on right now where the diligence is focusing on, my part of the diligence is focusing on the privacy and security aspects of it. And in one case, we're looking at this target company. It's actually the one that I mentioned earlier, that it's a data-rich company, and yet they have very little in their contracts. So it's becoming a bigger and a bigger issue. But I think to your specific question, in terms of convincing, that there's any number of horror stories out there that you can point to, I think what it comes back to is doing the risk assessment, and then as a result of that risk assessment, figuring out how you're going to allocate liability. So at the end of the day, the gentleman over here brought up the need for insurance. I wouldn't say there's a need. I would say it's a risk assessment issue, and you're shaking your head.
It's just not. doesn't resonate with most. It just doesn't resonate with most management teams.
So,
if you come at it from the horror story perspective, though, you may find that the head of sales is standing beside you, pounding the table as well. I mean, we're all analytical in here. We're all risk assessors. We're all people who think about legal problems, and that's important. But if you're really going to have an impact inside of a corporation, you'd better be able to talk about things that the senior management team really cares about. If you're sitting at a table with the executive committee, what do they care about? Mm-hmm. Well, they care about hitting the numbers. They care about getting their bonuses based on hitting the numbers. And they care about their stock options increasing in value because of hitting the numbers.
But those are all short-term.
Yeah. Welcome to corporate America. Welcome, welcome to publicly traded companies. I mean, that's the world that, if you've been inside a corporation, that's the world you live in. So you got to get outside of that rubric. That's my opinion.
Can I just say two seconds on it?
Please.
So at IAPP last week, which I couldn't go, but I prepared all the materials, so I know what was going to be in the session I was going to do. Someone else did for me. But I had a whole hour on that topic. And it's very contextual, so it's very difficult to answer for every company. I figured out a way to make it resonate with our board and our C-suite, but that doesn't mean necessarily, because of the nature of my business, that's going to resonate with somebody else. But you absolutely have to figure out the hook. And I don't think, actually, that it's scare tactics. You got to figure out how to make them personally care, true, but I don't know that it's somebody else's horror, because they'll just distinguish themselves from it.
Okay, well, thank you for a wonderful first session to my panelists. Thank you.